What if there were a fountain of youth pill that could add decades to your life? Would you take it? Unlocking the Fountain is a podcast about the mysteries of aging and the scientific quest to slow, stop, or even reverse it.
When do you think we're going to have the first 150-year-old? I think that person's already alive.
Unlocking the Fountain. Available now on CBC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is a CBC podcast.
Hey there, I'm Rosemary Barton.
And I'm Elamine Abdul-Mahmoud.
And this is Party Lines.
Rosie, for the first time in Ontario's history, the government has used the constitutional nuclear option. Doug Ford's government invoked the notwithstanding clause this week. That was so his government could pass legislation limiting third-party election advertising after a judge said that violated the right of freedom of speech. So this week, we're going to go deep into the Charter of Rights and Freedoms to look at its most controversial section. I love it. I love it.
You know, I love it too. Meanwhile, Green Party leader Annamie Paul lost one of her MPs to the Liberals, so that's a third of her caucus now gone. And she's facing growing discontent among the membership. She's had the job for less than a year. What does it mean for the Green Party? What does it mean for Paul?
It's Party Lines Drama Edition. Let's do this. Oof. Okay, I'm excited for this one. Today's show is full of dramatic turns. Let's start with this bill that just took effect in Ontario. And it's a bill that was introduced by Doug Ford and the Progressive Conservatives. And essentially what it does is restrict how third parties can spend their money on political advertising ahead of any kind of election. The law that the PCs are tinkering with here is not a new law. It was originally introduced by Kathleen Wynne to keep big money out of politics. So, you know, before there were certain restrictions on how much third parties, like unions or advocacy groups, could spend on political messaging about 6 months before an election. Ford made that period a whole year before an election, but kept the spending limit the same. And they made this argument that this move will keep big money out of politics. So unions can't suddenly spend big bucks for a whole year before an election.
I should also add that it's not just unions. There would also be partisan sort of lobbying groups that would be part of this, would be considered third parties, like Ontario Proud.
Oh, yes, that's right. So the opposition says, hey, this is anti-democratic, which is, of course, up for debate. But like, that's what an opposition's job is to oppose and say, hey, the thing that you're doing is not great. Anyway, the bill ends up in court. And a judge last week says, actually, this bill is unconstitutional because the PCs pulled this year before the election thing out of a hat. Like, there's no explanation for this. They just kind of arbitrarily said, for this period. Mm-hmm. That's where things get dramatic. And I'm like rubbing my hands with excitement.
I can hear it. I know.
It really is happening. Okay, so then Doug Ford recalled the Ontario legislature invoked the nuclear option, aka Section 33, which is the notwithstanding clause. And what the section does, for folks who are not familiar, is it lets provinces say, well, okay, fine, this law we just passed is unconstitutional, but we're going to override the charter for 5 years, and we're just going to do it anyway. And chaos. I mean, not really, because like I've had a lot of conversations with like relatively political friends, and not one of them was like, you know what I want to talk about is this huge story. But it is a big deal because it's the first time that it's ever been used in Ontario. And it's like the courts played this powerful card and Ontario was like, here's a counterspell that's really powerful. And it raises the question, should we have a counterspell card against the charter? Is this how we should operate this democracy? I love it.
And we have to answer that? Is that you?
We do.
I have like, to answer that?
Right now. Yeah, in the next 10 minutes, Rosie.
Yeah, it's super fascinating. And it's also a conversation that we have sort of sporadically in this country when a province decides to invoke the notwithstanding clause, which happens very, very rarely. Our producer, Richard, wanted to make sure we said that. Very rarely. Quebec has used it multiple times, which probably won't surprise people. They've used it with Bill 21, which is the bill that prevents people from wearing religious symbols at work in public service positions. They've used it already with Bill 96, which is their new language law. New Brunswick almost used it with a mandatory vaccination policy. Alberta almost used it around the same-sex marriage law back in 2000, but didn't end up having to. All that to say is there are attempts to use it. There are threats to use it, would probably be the better way to put it, by provinces to sometimes say we're willing to go this far and then some sort of compromise is reached or someone backs down or the courts change their minds. It's super interesting, I think, to look at it from different political, ideological perspectives. Liberals, who, of course, brought in the charter under Pierre Trudeau, would say that this is something that was done in order to placate a couple of provinces, in order for the Constitution to be repatriated, and that it is, as you say, the nuclear option. It is the last thing any government should ever consider in order to suspend rights. Conservatives would have a different view. Conservatives would say this is vital to allowing politicians and policymakers to push forward their agenda and not be held back by the courts. And both of those positions are, I think, valid in this conversation. I think what the question is whether in this instance, in particular, this is about politics as opposed to policy, where it makes sense that you would need to suspend the rights. And a whole lot of people are certainly saying that this is about politics and Doug Ford and his party not wanting to see overwhelming criticism during a writ period leading up to next June.
Right. Like, what's been an interesting fallout is that few people are talking about the substance of the bill. Like, sure, you can change a lot about how democracy works. Like, that is something that a lot of parties do. But everyone is now talking about how they're getting there. Like, it's kind of like using a helicopter to get across town. Like, no one's asking about your destination. It's just like, why are you taking that to get there? And I feel like it's hard to overlook the fact that, like you mentioned, you know, in Quebec, Section 33 is like brushing your teeth. Like, you wake up, you have a shower, and then you use Section 33 to override some stuff. But in Ontario, the idea that this is new territory is significant. Ford has threatened it before. He threatened to use it when he was pushing to reduce the size of the Toronto City Council. But that threat used to be enough. Like, it was like the specter of using it kept it from actually being deployed. It was like, oh no, they're going to go for the nuclear option. Maybe we should back down here. But now that it has been pulled, it raises all these questions about the use case. Because is it actually an emergency to limit spending on third parties? Like, are people screaming in the streets, if I hear one more union ad on the radio, I will lose it? Like, is that what's happening? Or is it perhaps that these third parties are, to be blunt, less likely to make a big ad spend saying you should vote PC? And it is, in fact, in Ford's interest to make sure that their ability to spend is affected. That's not a nefarious thing. Nearly every party gets into power and figures out a way to tip the scale slightly to make it harder for the other guy to get support or get money. But not every party pushes the big red button and says it is imperative that our political interests be protected and the charter should, like, take a seat.
Yeah, and I think in the case, if you look at Quebec, whether it be around, well, they would call it a secularism bill, or whether you look at language laws, those are two things that criticize the legislation as much as you want. But they, the Quebec government, in those two instances, François Legault's government, would argue that they are overriding the charter to protect the identity of Quebec, the language of Quebec, and the culture of Quebec. You can dispute that, but that's what they would say. So you can sort of understand why they might make the case that Section 33 should be used. In the case of this particular one, I don't think that third-party financing speaks to the identity of Ontario, our need to survive, what could happen to our rights if we were to be bombarded with third-party ads for 12 months. Like, clearly the scale is a little bit different. And unfortunately, the only way right now for citizens to judge whether the notwithstanding clause is being well used or not is with an election. That's really the only sort of safety mechanism that's built into all of this. The fact that it does expire after 5 years, that's sort of the normal electoral cycle. And that's when people can weigh in and say, you know what, that didn't make a whole lot of sense to me and I'm not cool with that. I think what critics seem to be saying, though, is if you start to use it more and for things like what we're seeing in Ontario, does it start to normalize the use of it? And how does that affect the country's rights overall? And I think that that's a pretty good question to ask. And should we be, as citizens, worried about that?
Right. It's not so much the story as what it opens the door to, because we are kind of in politically unprecedented grounds in terms of this kind of use for the clause. Like, it is a blatantly political moment to use the notwithstanding clause. So if Ford is going to do this, does that open the door to other premiers to do that? Certainly the constitutional scholars are banging at the tables. Of course, they're in the back of the room because I'm sorry, constitutional scholars. But they are banging at the table saying, no, this is not what this thing is for. And the question is, like, is anyone going to listen to them?
Yeah, you know, to be fair, conservatives would say, no, this is exactly what it's for. This was the whole point of putting this in the Constitution, was to allow provinces to make these decisions and claim their own powers to make their own laws, for it not to be influenced unduly by the court. And you can understand that that is the argument that provinces would make. But I think you have to also be willing to defend fiercely why you're doing it in this instance. For now, I have to say, maybe what is allowing the Ontario government to avoid a huge amount of criticism is what you said off the top, that election financing is not generally why people take to the streets, right? This is not, they are not feeling this directly in their everyday lives. And so maybe they'll be able to do it and move through it without it becoming a huge issue. But that doesn't mean that it shouldn't be.
Hey, my name's Jamie Poisson, and I'm the host of Front Burner. It's the CBC's daily news podcast. And every day, we're discussing the big events and fault lines shaping Canada and the world. Politics, economics, social movements, you name it. Sometimes we even talk about really fun stuff, like the enduring relevance of Lord of the Rings. You can hear Front Burner on CBC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
All right, you were excited to talk about Section 33, felt it contained a lot of drama somehow.
Yes.
Let me bring more drama, my friend. Let me bring the drama. Let me bring the actual drama to this podcast. And it comes in the form of the Green Party.
Oh, unexpected source of drama.
I know. Yes. A party that up until a week ago had three elected MPs in the House is now down to two. Party that, you know, is sort of just plugging along, hoping to improve its vote count in the next election. And now has been sort of blown up, might be the right word, at least hit by a couple of things. By the politics of the Middle East, complicated, and the leadership's response. So Annamie Paul has been leader for not even a year. She does not have a seat in the House, as you know, as many of our listeners probably know. She tried to and failed. So she leads from outside of the House. She's in Ottawa pretty regularly. She does lots of interviews and scrums, but she is not in the House and able to, you know, ask questions of the Prime Minister and that kind of thing. Well, over the past week or so, one of her MPs, Jenica Atwin from Fredericton, decided that she was going to leave the Green Party and become a Liberal MP. So now she is. So that's one third of the party.
Yes.
That's gone. And you can trace some of this back to when the crisis in the Middle East was unfolding most recently. Annamie Paul put out a statement that called for a ceasefire, condemned Palestinian rocket attacks, and talked about the excessive military force coming from the Israelis. Jenica Atwin didn't like that statement. She called it inadequate, and she essentially went to bat for the Palestinians and called what was happening there an apartheid. Paul Manley, another Green MP, did the same. He also criticized the statement, thought it was too weak. This led the senior advisor to Annamie Paul. I didn't know this is so long, but just bear with me.
I'm here with you.
Okay. to take to Facebook on May 14th and call out their own MPs for what he called anti-Semitism and discrimination. He also called out Jagmeet Singh and, sadly, Green MPs. He didn't name them. He said that we will work to defeat you.
Enemy so Paul's advisor said he will work to defeat Green. Okay, wow.
That's right, right. Yeah. And labeled all these people anti-Semites. Now, there has been, you know, ongoing sort of back and forth around the timeline. How much did this actually influence Jenica Atwin's decision to leave? But what it has resulted in was on Tuesday night, the council, the Green Party Federal Council, gets together and decides that they are not going to hold a vote yet to get rid of Annamie Paul, but they are going to require Annamie Paul, the leader of the party, to make a statement that she denounces the comments of her advisor and that she fully supports her caucus. And so that's where we are when we record this. This may happen later today. And if it doesn't, it's possible Annamie Paul isn't around much longer. But like, holy schmoly, like what? Who knew the Green Party could be this fraught?
Oh,
I don't know.
Gosh.
What do you think is going on there?
I love this story. I love this story. I love this story so much. And I love it because it is an equal opportunity landmine. Like, there's a chance it could blow up in every single person's face. Annamie Paul's position has been that Jenica Atwin crossing has been in the works for a while, and the whole conversation about criticism of Israel was just basically a manufactured reason for her departure. But it doesn't look good for her as a leader to have lost a member of her caucus, a third of her caucus, because her caucus was three people. Jenica Atwin, you know, made history with her election, but the Greens actually do have a few seats in her home province, so there's a possibility this could backfire on her. Trudeau appears to be easily the person who comes out on top by gaining an MP, which is like a huge win, but like, her views on Israel don't exactly align with the Liberal parties, and there's no good reason why this doesn't present a future source of tension again, if not like right now. I don't know, even like Elizabeth May, the former leader of the Greens, has been like quite widely reported to be at odds with Annamie Paul very publicly, and May has been the face of the party for so long that I think it's a big deal to undermine the very first person to take over after you. Like, everyone has something to lose. God, who else? The NDP. The NDP has something to lose because, you know, they might think they're the winners here because the Greens were nipping at their heels for a bit, but Atwin made it explicit when she was leaving the Greens that there was only one place she felt she could go, and that was the Liberal Party. And could that be for electability reasons? Sure. But it's also true that, you know, if you're a progressive person, you'd look at that and go, why would a Green MP go to the Liberals and not the NDP? It's just like the stakes feel high for everyone, and it just like happened very quickly.
Yeah, we should point out that Atwin, since becoming a Liberal, has altered her position on the Middle East, saying that now her words were actually intended to send, quote, strength and support to people in need, that she recognizes Palestinians and Israelis are suffering. So it would seem that someone in the Liberal Party's probably had a conversation with her around how far
she
can go.
You might say so.
But the other thing to keep in mind here, and these are important facts too, is that Annamie Paul is herself Jewish, and that she is the only female leader of color in the House. These are not insignificant facts when it comes to this conversation, because it then becomes sort of what is going on here in the party. Is this about policy, or is this about style of leadership and ability to lead a party? Can you even lead a party that is really built on trying to get everyone to just sort of respect each other's positions? It was only this week that Annamie Paul really took, in my view, any responsibility for how this unfolded. Here's a bit of what she said.
I'm willing to recognize anything that I might have done to contribute to the situation. It's important for me to grow and learn always as a leader and be humble enough to recognize that.
We are like months, probably. We are probably months out from an election. This is not how you want to be heading into an election. Even if Annamie Paul does what they want her to do here and she gets past this hump, she is deeply, deeply weakened by her own party. Mm-hmm. And it seems hard for me to see how she goes into an election in a position of strength. I just don't see it.
You might reasonably characterize like the last few years of the Green Party as a journey towards professionalization, like towards just being seen as
a professional,
sort of national party. And this undermines that with one move. Like, the idea that there's this much sort of infighting and tension, and the leader that the party was so excited about just has arrived at this point it does a lot. It really does a lot to undermine everything that the Greens have worked towards in terms of like building this image. The other thing I would say is that there have already been not criticisms, but maybe questions about Annie Paul's decision making because she's insistent on running in Toronto Centre, probably the safest Liberal riding in the country. I mean, it doesn't get much safer than Toronto Centre. And sure enough, in a by-election, she did pretty well, but she didn't come even close to winning that by-election. Yeah. And she wants to run there again. So that continues to sort of raise questions about her judgment as a leader. One could think of like Guelph, for example, just a couple hours outside of Toronto, where the Greens already have a provincial seat. And so it would be very easy to imagine that she would maybe be able to build a support there. But she was not really, you know, having that conversation. I mean, the other thing about all of this is that floor crossings can sometimes be a harbinger of like an election to come. You know, people start to get restless. People start to think about, oh, man, am I going to get elected if I continue to be with this party? And when you see a decision like this, it kind of feels like there's an energy in the air that everyone's starting to think about their own future election prospects. And if a third of the Green caucus feels like they can't get elected with the Green Party and they leave, it raises questions about that professionalization that's been happening inside the Green Party for so long.
Yeah, and I think it also raises questions about how this party works moving forward after Elizabeth May, you know, who was the leader of the party for so long and who managed to sort of shape it in her image. Now, some people, you know, weren't down with the image, but after she decided she didn't want to be leader anymore, there's a question about, so what is this party and who does this party represent? This is not a problem unique to the Greens, right? You could argue this is the problem that the Conservatives had after Stephen Harper left and Andrew Scheer did not succeed in defining who the party was without Stephen Harper. That it's not unlike what's happening here. So it wouldn't be unprecedented to see the first sort of person out of the gate to replace Liz May potentially not succeed. But I do think that the Green Party has a lot more to lose because they felt like they were gaining some momentum, and this could totally, you know, put the brakes on that. That is legit the sound of me on a patio in Ontario.
At last.
At last. I haven't done it yet, but I am heading to a lunch right after this.
I can't believe you haven't done it. I've done it three times.
Since. Shut up.
It's really? Incredible. It's amazing. I've clinked many glasses. It's great.
And I'm going to a working lunch, so it's not even going to be. Anyway, I'm proud of you. I'm proud of anyone who's doing it.
Thank you.
It's also the sound of last call. Last week, we asked, how do you feel Canada should confront its history when it comes to existing statues, monuments, and even street names?
We had some really interesting perspectives. One listener tweeted, statues don't have feelings or experience trauma, but people do. A lot of emphasis is being placed on tangible items as markers of intangible relationships people have with this country slash their identity. Maybe we need to talk about where people believe their history is located and communicated.
Another listener asked this question. Are there any actual reconciliation efforts other than removing statues and renaming buildings?
Perhaps in a similar vein, another listener took issue with the question. They said, this is so disgusting. I refuse to have a conversation that involves justifying vandalism.
Another listener said, I want to agree with the heavy sentiment the last couple of weeks' news has brought. Often I had a smug feeling that we Canadians are better than the U.S. Reality simply makes that untrue. Thanks. Oh, so yeah, we tried not to be so bleak this week, but yes. sometimes you just gotta go there. This week we want you to weigh in on Section 33 of the Constitution, but we'll make it real simple. Do you think government should be allowed to override the courts, and when should they be allowed to do that? You can tweet us. I'm at Rosie Barton.
And I'm at Elamine88. Throw in the hashtag. Our hashtag is PartyLines, and let us know what you think.
That is it for Party Lines this week from CBC News and CBC Podcasts. I'm Rosemary Barton, Chief Political Correspondent for CBC News.
And I'm Elamine Abdul Mahmoud, Culture Writer for BuzzFeed News.
See you next week.
I'll see you then.
For more CBC Podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.